This audio stream is a rough edit of the proceedings at the conference From JFK Through 9-1-1, 42 Years of State-Sponsored Terrorism. This audio stream is the first of two for this conference. The conference was held at the Central Library in downtown Portland, Oregon, on the afternoon of Sunday, November the 20th, 2005, from about 1 to 4:30 p.m. Much of the content of this audio recording is expert testimony recorded at other conferences held over the last several years that trace covert operations from the mysterious circumstances surrounding the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, America's 35th president, on November 22, 1963, to the increasingly discredited official account of the events of September 11, 2001, as embodied in the Keene-Zelikoff Commission report released July 22, 2004. The facilitator for this event, whose voice you will hear at intervals throughout the proceedings, is Richard Frager of the PDX 9/11 Truth Alliance. And I'm Glenn Owen, KWFM on the World Wide Web.
Later, it became a major headquarters of the CIA in the Far East, and that's why Oswald was there as a Marine augmenting the CIA's capabilities. Well, you know, there was another one of these coincidences in my career that became useful later because I knew the base pretty well. I never met Oswald there. I was finishing up some of that flying. The surrender had taken place on board the Missouri, and I went back to Okinawa after one flight, and some of my men needed uniforms, so I went down the harbor. A very odd thing was happening. Okinawa was loaded with equipment, stacked up three or four pallets high, because we had intended to invade Japan with 500,000 men, and the invasion didn't come off. So I saw all this stuff being reloaded onto these American ships, and I asked the harbor master, I said, is that going back to the States? He said, hell no, they never want to see all these tanks and guns and ambulances and 105 millimeter howitzers and all the rest of the stuff. He said, we're shipping this to Hanoi. And at that time, Hanoi didn't ring too many bells with me. I knew where it was, but it was not part of the war as far as we were concerned. And he said, that's half of it. The other half is going to Korea. And believe it or not, back there, with the end of World War II, somebody had made plans to provide an enormous stockpile of modern arms and equipment to Syngman Rhee in Korea and actually to Ho Chi Minh in Hanoi. And Ho Chi Minh in those days was accompanied by an American Army general named Gallagher and an OSS man named Conein, who would be both became famous later in the Vietnam War. So you see, acting as no more than an ordinary pilot doing my job, but getting some rather unusual assignments, you begin to acquire a little information that doesn't show up in history books. Who was it that ever, looking ahead that far, ordered the movement of that enormous stockpile of equipment specifically to Seoul, Korea, and to Hanoi in Vietnam?
I think most of what we're going to see today is not in history books, for obvious reasons. There are history texts. What is presented as history is pretty much nonsense.
During that flying between Okinawa and Japan, I received orders from the Army to report to Yale University. The Air Force had never had a ROTC program because always was part of the Army program.
The time is 5 minutes before one. We're at the Public Library and Central Library in downtown Portland, getting ready for From JFK to 9-1-1. 42 Years of State-Sponsored Terrorism is presented by the PDX 9-11 Truth Alliance and will be streamed from the KBOO website sometime this evening. That's November the 20th, Sunday, 2005.
The bank had over $1 billion when the United
States
had only about $15 billion banks in the country, and here this bank just grew up out of Vietnam with $1 billion. Well, the man running it then, half of it anyway, was Michael Hand. So you see the roles that worked themselves through the structure of what we call the Vietnam War were some of them rather interesting.
You mentioned the role of General Edward Lansdale in the Philippines. and in an operation there that had to do with overthrowing the government and involvement with the Hucks. These people, I assume, were also key characters in other similar operations like the Bay of Pigs.
Yes. When the Bay of Pigs was being planned, one of the biggest problems was to try to stay within the Cuban exile community, but there were no trained leaders within that community that we could trust the leadership work to. Manuel Artima was probably as close as we came to a real good military leader. So the agency, using Lansdale's contacts, brought people in from around the world, but a good number of them from Manila, like Valeriano was actually Magsaysay's deputy when he was president of the Philippines for special forces type work, or they call civil action work. He came over and helped work on the Bay of Pigs program along with others. The Bay of Pigs program was really a lot more involved than we ever got a chance to see because of the unfortunate failure to do it properly. It had been pretty well carried out, and the air support was a function, and I mean more or less just the air transport, air paradrop support, not military. Was a function of the CIA.
Who we are watching is Fletcher Prouty, who played Mr. X, Donald Sutherland, in the movie JFK. We'll be seeing a scene from JFK. Colonel Fletcher Prouty spent 9 of his 23-year military career in the Pentagon, 2 years with Secretary of Defense, 2 years with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and 5 years headquarters, U.S. Air Force. So he was the briefing officer for the Secretary of Defense in 60 through 61, and for the Chairman of the Joint Chief. And in the movie JFK, and also in this interview with John Judge, he explains how special operations work. And in real life, he resigned from the government in 64, not long after the JFK assassination, after he kind of figured it out that it was an inside job. So let's listen to Mr. Prouty, and then we'll wait and see what kind of crowd we have and start the discussions.
And you work them into teams, and then when you have the Indonesian rebellion, you move some of the same people in. Frank Wisner, the old OSS hand who was in Bucharest in Romania during World War II, became the leader of the Indonesian program. So your observation is correct. And Lansdale, of course, being really the legendary prime man in this business, was involved in many of these things, especially in the Pacific area.
This work included, I assume, also assassinations of government leaders or particular individuals. When did you begin to think that the assassination of President Kennedy might have fit this same mold?
I had known through experience that assassinations were called for in certain activities, usually as a fallback. Not, you know, if you're a talker guy and leaving, you do it. But if it doesn't work, or if the other people in the country can't work with the man, even in a compromised situation, the decision is made that there must be an assassination. And during the 1976 hearings under the Church Committee of the Senate, this was finally revealed, even though the agency tried to overlook the situation. It never hit me more strongly than early in Kennedy's administration, when a major general that I knew very well, Air Force officer, came back from a meeting in the White House. As he went by the door of my office, which was just across the hall from his, he said, "Prouty, go down to personnel and get me retirement papers right now." So I went down to personnel, got retirement papers. There was a man that might have been chief of staff of the Air Force, a very well-known general. So as I brought the papers in, I, "What's the matter, General?" He said, "I can't agree with it." He said, "We're sitting in the White House. We're talking about a certain program." He said, "The man that they're talking about is as anti-communist as anyone in the world, although they have certain arguments against this man, and they're going to remove him. And they can't remove him
peacefully, he won't go. They want to kill him. He said, I'm quitting. I won't go through this. And he walked out of the Air Force that afternoon. Well, obviously, that was a lesson to me because I had not been personally in that kind of situation, although I had provided aircraft for teams that were going for these jobs. I didn't ever see it that close as when that man told me what they had decided. Next morning, I read in the paper that the man was dead, the man on the head of the country. Put it together, you know, all you need to know about assassinations.
Did you have a sense at the time that he resigned in 1964 that the murder of Kennedy was suspicious in some way?
By that time, in fact, within days, I was positive of it. There were so many things not done. The secret of an assassination plan is to remove the protection. If you've been living in a neighborhood where you think having a big German shepherd dog is necessary for your safety, and if that dog is gone, somebody come in the house because the dog's gone, they won't come when the dog's there. See, if you remove the protection, you're going to have somebody assassinated. And it was evident in the area of Dallas that the Secret Service coverage either didn't exist, was at a minimum, and that the normal military augmentation of Secret Service coverage had not even taken place. And although I happened to be in New Zealand on the day President Kennedy was killed, and I was having breakfast with a congressman from the United States, we heard on the radio that the president was shot dead. And as soon as we could, we went out on the street and bought a newspaper from a man selling extras. And I saw a picture on the front page of the paper of that Texas school book building, which I'm sure had to have been taken, you know, right away and photocopied and sent around the world. And windows were open. And I turned to the congressman and said, you know, something is seriously wrong. The Secret Service closes windows. The military, you have plenty of people, close the windows and put stickers on them. Don't open a window till a president goes by. And then you put a man outside with a radio, and he looks at the building, just a glance at the building. He knows the windows are closed, so everything's all right. But if a window opens, he gets on the radio. There's a man up on a roof with a sniper gun watching, and other men come through the hall, go and see why the window was open and shut it. I mean, that's protection. You want to keep the president alive. You're not going to take the bubble top off his car. You're not going to put him in a car that isn't armored. The Secret Service didn't use an armored car. If the bubble had been on it anyway, it was nothing. It wouldn't have stopped. J. Edgar Hoover made a report to Johnson on that. He said that bubble top, whether it was on or not, didn't make any difference. It was worthless. He said, I wouldn't ride in that car across the street. So we noticed immediately, just being off in New Zealand in this paper, things that when I got back to Washington, I found out there's no way in the world that the president had been protected properly. Well, that can't happen. You train thousands of military men to do the job. They're going to do the job. That's their business. You train Secret Service men year in and year out to do the job. They're going to do it. But I called one of the military units to talk to a friend of mine because I had worked on that kind of business. And he said, you know, somebody called my colonel and said, we don't need your unit in Dallas. Well, he wasn't too shocked, although he was only in San Antonio and could have come up easily, because he figured they were going to put another unit in Dallas, and you know, it wasn't his job, he'd stay there. He found out afterwards that they didn't. Well, then who called? Who knew ahead of time, for reasons of the assassin's point of view, not to have that military unit there? It, you know, it would have to know code words, he would have to know all the secrets of how this thing is done. And I've done that. I've gone to Mexico City when Eisenhower went down there, preparing the road for our military units to augment Secret Service in Mexico City. We used extreme caution. It took weeks. And then Eisenhower could casually walk down the Avenida, the main street in the middle of town, and he's safe. At least he's as safe as you can make it. Well, that didn't happen. And you could see that right away in that first newspaper. And then when I got back to my office with the JCS and I had other resources to check other things. By the time I retired, and it wasn't just because of that, I had already arranged a job, but it was pretty much my whole idea of what I was doing came to an end right there. 9 years was enough. And I had no doubts that the murder was a carefully planned job and that Oswald was a patsy.
no question about it. And that the murderers were professionals that I knew existed, because Lyndon Johnson himself, before he died, said, "We operate a murder incorporated," meaning we operate people who can murder, but incorporated, that means in perpetuity. A business that is incorporated means perpetual. He further said, "I believe it was a conspiracy," and he said, "I believe that Oswald did not do it himself." Those are printed words that are available. Anybody wants to go to the library. So, you know, there were no doubts in my mind, and I think thousands of other people could see that also.
I know in my own research, I noticed similar things. For instance, the decision to take the double turn from Main Street to Houston and Elm that slowed the car down considerably, and the completely wrong reaction of the Secret Service driver on hearing the first of the gunfire to hit the brake instead of the gas, making it possible for an assassin to take a closer aim rather than speed. Both those things slowed the car down and made the assassination an easier hit or more possible. And there were other indications in that direction. But beyond that, many unusual things happened that day, November 22nd, at levels even above the planning in Dealey Plaza, that led me to think that this had to have been orchestrated in a military fashion, as a coup d'etat, on the highest level. You know the story well about my mother and the Pentagon, knowing that the plans about Vietnam were reversed immediately. I also, in my work with enlisted people during the Vietnam War, talked to Strategic Air Command bomber pilots at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, who were in the air that hour, and told me that when they heard the news that Kennedy had been shot, they raced for their code books, the books in special lockers that link them to the cryptic codes from the White House command rooms or the different command control centers or the president himself, that would have allowed them to participate in a nuclear or national emergency response. In each of the planes in the air that hour, they told me no code books were to be had. The lockers were empty. That's reported also for Air Force One by Pierre Salinger. We have reports that the entire communication grid in the federal offices went down for a period of an hour and a half to 2 hours at the time Kennedy was shot. And I wondered if your work, and looking at it from your angle, you saw things that made you feel that this had to have been more than just the security being withdrawn, but an operation planned at the top.
Well, you know, I think I've told you, John, I was aware of your mother's role, that the work she did was just not too far down the hall from where I worked. I didn't know her, but we knew that they were doing that planning, because every time something would change in the war planning, it was reflected in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, of course. And we knew there were changes because Kennedy was telling people to come home, and all of a sudden the word went out to build a force up. Something changed drastically. And the other side of it is, I have never been able to find out why, or to even find a rational idea in my own mind, why the Kennedy cabinet was on the way to Tokyo at the time he was killed. I don't know of any time when most of the cabinet for any president was going any further than across the river. You know, here they all were on an airplane on the way from Honolulu to Tokyo when they hear about the president being shot. That's quite unusual. Or even the little line in the Pentagon Papers that says so much. Ambassador Lodge, who had come from Saigon to the meeting in Honolulu before a large staff, which was a customary thing, including these cabinet officers, then it said, on the 22nd of November, Ambassador Lodge flew to Washington to speak to the president. Didn't say which president. By the time they wrote the Pentagon Papers, they knew President Kennedy had died. Why couldn't they find a little bit of space to put in President Johnson, because that's the day Kennedy died? Or some, they go on for pages after that, never mention Kennedy's name, although this is... I mean, why are people playing with the record like that? See, or why are they playing with the protection system in Dallas?
There's a lot of similarities between the JFK assassination and 9/11. And for people my age group, the two biggest events in the past 50 years would be the JFK assassination and 9/11. And
we're going to try to illuminate some of the information about that. And we'll be showing a question.
Yeah, I've been to some other 9/11 talks like this, and I've never heard from anybody a reasonable explanation right after the attacks. All the TVs could talk about was that there's 10,000 people in these buildings, and at the end it was just under 3,000.
Right. If, you know, it's interesting, 9/11 was planned to minimize damage. If it was hit an hour later, there would have been 10,000. Yeah, they would. I mean, the whole thing was done to minimize damage. If it was hit an hour or two later, 10,000-15,000 people. And the plane that hit the Pentagon hit the part that had been under construction for 2-3 years, 50 dead, not where the Joint Chiefs were, hundreds and hundreds of dead or thousands. So the whole 9/11 operation was done to minimize damage, 2-3,000 dead.
Okay. So the people that were murdered there were the most
excitable ones. Mm-hmm. And there were plenty of warnings, just like the JFK assassination. There were plenty of warnings, too. The people who needed to know were briefed on it. That's how these operations are planned out. But we have a lot of video and a lot of text, a lot of everything, and going to try to squeeze about 1,000 hours in 3 hours. And we're really not here to try to prove or disprove anything. We're just trying to touch some of the main topics, points of this material. And another thing, too, is we're not trying to figure out who did it. I mean, because if you really try to figure out who shot Kennedy, or who didn't, or who flew the planes in 9/11, it probably wouldn't tell you anything, because most likely you would have, there were cutouts or patsies, like Oswald said, he's a patsy, which was a lot different than saying I'm guilty. So it's the question is, why were these events done, and who benefits and who still benefits, which are the key questions to ask. Now I'm going to read just a paragraph. People often ask, why does the Kennedy assassination still matter, especially to a younger crowd, or most people these days? And it's a good question, one worthy of a longer and more detailed response than we'll give. Ultimately, each person needs to answer that question for themselves, but here's one response. And apply this to 9/11 also. When the government can flat-out lie to its citizens about the death of its own president, when the truth is knowable, when the conspirators still living are not prosecuted, when the accessories after the fact still grind out the disinformation, when a concerted campaign to publish books promoting the big lie can go unchallenged, and when the media is not held accountable for its participation in the 42-year cover-up now, then our Constitution is meaningless. Our laws without substance. Our people without hope of ever participating in the pseudo-democracy that passes for America. If we allow ourselves to be lied to in so blatant a fashion about something as important as the assassination of a president, can we really expect the government or the media to tell us the truth about anything after all that? Is that why Watergate happened, Iran-Contra? If no one is held accountable, then anything goes. We are only just now finding out about the operation during the Vietnam War, where this was about 5 years ago, to spray nerve gas on deserters, although we did find out about the white phosphorus on Fallujah about a month after that happened, or about 6 months, I should say. What is going on now that we cannot know for another 30 years? George Orwell wrote in his famous book, 1984, who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. He wasn't being facetious. He was giving us a strong warning and one that should be well heeded. Don't give up your history. And today we're going to try to explain and correct that history. Questions? Yes.
You know, two other assassinations that seem to be extremely fishy. Paul Wellstone.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's a good new book on Wellstone.
Mm-hmm. And then John Jr., I mean...
JFK Jr.
John Jr.
Right.
You know, I mean, really, he had presidents written all over.
Well, this country has a long history of assassinations. Besides the 60s assassinations, Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, Malcolm X, and Walter Reuther, labor leader, auto union. And, you know, Prouty brings up a point. The FBI kept telling them that his dog was making a ruckus to take away his dog. And Reuther said, no, the dog's not making any noise. He's okay. And they kept harassing him. Well, they did get rid of the dog, and that's when they killed him. So taking away the protection is... and slowing down on Elm Street there was Houston and Elm, was how slow enough for the snipers could shoot Kennedy. But you think about 9/11 too, the same deal. You have military planes all around told to stand down. Of course, we know now they were all on war games and false blips on the radar screen. So it was really difficult too. I mean, it was obviously a planned operation. 9/11 was a planned operation. As we shall see, I'll show. Yes?
Yeah, I did want to mention you talked about assassinations. There was a bunch of them around Lincoln's time. There were, I forget how many presidents were killed in that period of time, and there was supposedly foreign influence that brought it about.
Interesting. Okay. Yes, Bruce?
I've heard that. Some people think that a lot of the rock stars during the Vietnam War era that these deaths were not accidental. Is there any?
Yeah, there's a book by Alex Constantine called The War on Rock, and he goes through the assassinations, the Brian Jones, Bob Marley, John Lennon. John Lennon definitely came out of the same teams. Yeah, there is something to that. Joplin, Hendrix, right. They're very curious. There's a book by Alex Constantine about that. So ask me, you know, outside of the meeting, I can give you the ISBN number. So every year in Dallas, there's a group that meets. The group is called COPA, Committee on Political Assassinations. In fact, they're meeting this weekend. Today's the last day. And because of the movie JFK, it kind of stirred interest in to re-examining this case. And I'm going to show some of that conference of a few years ago. And we can hear some of the people anyway.
In his passing, and I dedicate this gathering to him. And at this time, I'd like to turn over things to our sister group, the Coalition on Political Assassinations, who is over here. They're going to do a countdown ceremony to 12:30 from Zapruder's perch. John Judge is the secretary of the organization, and his dear friend, Mr. Penn Jones, started doing this every year. He would stand up on Zapruder's perch and do a countdown until 12:30, and then he would have a moment of silence. He's passed on as well, and now his dear friend John Judge will take up from where he left off. So John, I'll turn things over to you. Thank you very much everyone for coming. Appreciate it.
Judge, and I work with the Coalition on Political Assassinations out of Washington, D.C. We're a national network of the serious researchers, forensic, ballistic, medical, academic, and independent researchers from around the country who have worked on the John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King assassinations over the last 39 years, from the beginnings of this case till today. We were responsible, the individual groups that formed the coalition, the Committee for an Open Archives, the Assassination Archive and Research Center in Washington, D.C., the Citizens for Truth About the Kennedy Assassination. We were responsible in the 1990s for getting the JFK Records Act passed and for overseeing the release of now 6 million pages of files, the largest release of classified documents in American history. We're now working on getting a bill that was just introduced at the end of Congress by Cynthia McKinney, will be reintroduced in the next session, to release the files on the life and assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, which are still locked up. There continue to be files that need to be released on the Kennedy assassination as well, especially military intelligence files. And we're doing this in the face of increased government secrecy. There was a cartoon in the Washington Post yesterday that showed Mr. Poindexter, one of the Contragate criminals, and Mr. Ashcroft sitting in front of computers, and the computers say, "Everything you ever did." And then two policemen are leading a guy away from it, and they have him arm in arm, and he says, "All I was trying to do is ask what they have on me." And the cop says, "They're charging you with violating their right to privacy." We live in Washington, D.C., and we know there the joke in D.C. is if Dick Cheney dies of a heart attack, Bush could become president. When we have an alert in D.C., Cheney goes down into a mountainside in Bluemont, Virginia, into a hole, and Bush stays up with us while we wait for the imminent attack. But we live in a time now where it's more important than ever to have democracy. Practicing democracy between wars is like being a vegetarian between meals. We have to make a democracy out of this society if we're going to survive, if the world is going to survive. And the beginnings of this process started on November 22, 1963, with a military coup d'etat of this country. And we've been, as Penn Jones, a researcher and friend of mine who lived here in Texas and studied the case, said years ago, we've been in the death grip of that military-industrial complex since that day, November 22, 1963, and then he used to say, "Now let's all pray that I'm wrong." But I'm afraid he wasn't wrong, and that those forces still contend to run this country behind the shadow of a national security state that has stolen our history, that has made our history into a commodity of that state, that has classified it and locked it up. Our military history records alone from the end of World War II are in a classified archive in Suitland, Maryland, in underground buildings, an acre each in size. There are 27 buildings, 27 acres of classified documents, just the military history that we're not allowed to know of our own country from the end of World War II. When a people do not own their own history, they are a conquered people. And if we want to remain conquered, we'll leave our history in their hands. But our task has been to unearth this history that they want hidden from you and from the rest of us, and to dig up the truth of what's happened. Since that day till now. So we come out here every year, and I've come out here with Penn Jones when there used to be four of us standing in the rain for the last 39 years. Come out every year for a moment of silence here to commemorate what happened on November 22, 1963. And we're holding a conference this weekend right over here at the Hotel Lawrence in the building next to it. We'll have some of the best research speakers in the country over there talking about the new evidence in these cases. We'll be at the Adolphus tonight. And you can get information about that from us. But we're here now today and in this moment to try to remember someone who in June of 1963 spoke at the graduation ceremony at American University and said, he asked, "What kind of peace does America want?" He said, "Not a Pax Americana." And he stood against them. He was going to pull out of Vietnam. He was going to reverse the arms race. He was going to end the Cold War. He was going to change the country in a direction that it's been reversed since his death and keeps going in. And he was going to stand up to them. And that's part of the reason that he was eliminated, and his brother was not allowed to get into office either. So we come out every year to commemorate John F. Kennedy, what he stood for, what we lost, and what we need to gain back if we're going to have a democracy in this country. So I'd ask you just to join with us in a moment of silence now, and then we'll have one or two speakers from the conference say a few words. This is Walt Brown. He's the author of People vs. Lee Harvey Oswald, a book called The War on a Mission, a very good index on the entire Warren Commission record.
and one of the better researchers in the country. He's going to be our keynote speaker tonight at the Utah office.
39 years ago, just about right now, a car took a very wide turn at that corner. When it got right about there, the country took a very wide turn. The only way we're going to put the country back on the road that it was on is by you people. Thank you for coming out today.
We're going to be having presentations and panels on the counter-critics and the new books that are coming out and about to come out, trying to support the Warren Commission and what we know will be wrong with those books. We're going to have panels about the new evidence in the various assassination cases. We're going to have a panel on Sunday, including Dick Gregory, about what happened on 9/11 and some of the best research on that case as well, and what the reality is behind the events that have led to where we are today. So appreciate if folks want to join us. We have other speakers coming tonight. Bill Turner, a former FBI agent who just wrote the book Rearview Mirror. So they're going to be independent investigators and researchers talking here in Dallas all weekend. It's nice to see a lot of people here. Ever since Oliver Stone's film, there have been hundreds of people that come out now to commemorate these events on November 22nd. And to take a look at this historic place. Although, when I think about it, and you look at it, this is pretty much the dead end of Dallas. It's on the way out of town. It's an industrial park, more or less. A jail down here, and a book depository, and a post office building. Not much here, not much of a place to die. As Kennedy was on his way out of town, he's shot down like a dog in the street, and his murder remains unsolved to this day in an official way, although it's no mystery to most of us where those bullets came from that day. We don't have to study the blade of grass or the grassy knoll or the sewer to the front or the book depository because we know those bullets came from the Pentagon. That was the direction that they took. And they felled him that day, and they've been in charge since. I spoke to the Strategic Air Command bomber pilots that were in the air the hour of the John F. Kennedy assassination out of Omaha, Nebraska, on eight-hour shifts. And they were up in the air when they got radio chatter that the president had been shot. And they thought that they would get an emergency call because the president is dead by parties unknown. The first guy arrested later is somebody who's been called a communist and defected to Russia. And so these guys, just on the moment of hearing it, went to get their decrypting books. They have books aboard with a special code. They change them on a regular basis. That code tells them if they're getting a message from the black box. The White House communication, or from the war room in the Pentagon, or the Situation Room at the White House, or from the president aboard Air Force One. And then first they get a verifying code, and then they decrypt whatever message comes in. So they went to get their book, assuming there might be an emergency message with the president just shot in Dallas. And they did not have a code book aboard the plane. And when they landed, they talked to the other pilots on the ship, and none of them had a code book aboard the plane. And the hour of the Kennedy assassination, the entire defense of the United States was down. There was no way to activate those planes, to send them against a foreign country, or to defend the nation as they had to in that moment. And there is no mafia goon. There is no CIA schlepper. There's no oil man in Dallas that could have touched those books. The person who designed that system is named General Curtis LeMay. He was no friend of the Kennedys. He ran on Wallace's ticket in the 1960s. He hated the Kennedys from the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis on. And he would have known how to dismantle that system, and I would contend that he did. My mother was five levels above top security at the Pentagon, the highest paid woman employee, for 30 years. She projected the draft call for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And she told me when she retired that in April of 1963, they told her for the first time in her career to change her projections on Vietnam and to put in a withdrawal of all American troops by the end of 1964 on orders from the Kennedy White House. And I asked her, when did they tell you they would escalate the war? Because she projected 5 years ahead what the draft call would be for the whole nation, and she had to be among the first to know. And she told me late November of 63, I said the last week, she said the Monday following the Kennedy assassination, with Kennedy literally just in his grave, they came to her with the reversal figures and she couldn't believe them. She took them back to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and she said, these can't be right. And I used to tease my mother that that was the first civilian protest of the war in Vietnam. And she took it up there because on November 25th, 1963, the Joint Chiefs told her they were going into a 10-year war with 57,000 American dead. They knew exactly what it would take and what it would cost and where they were going, and she could barely believe it. But they handed her those figures as soon as Kennedy was dead, and they reversed that process that he had for withdrawal and went into a longer war. My mother and my aunt both worked at the Pentagon, and they told me the hour of the Kennedy assassination, the federal exchange phones between the offices, those are the secure lines that the offices call each other on, the State Department or the Pentagon or the White House. All those went down right at the time of the Kennedy assassination for a period of 2 hours. Now that, ladies and gentlemen, is a military coup d'etat. That is not some independent group doing something with the president because they didn't like him. That is a military takeover happening that day. The black box disappeared from Air Force One, didn't go back with Johnson. Dick Cheney in San Francisco a few weeks ago at the Chamber of Commerce talk that he gave out there at the Commerce Club, he said he has the black box. He who has the black box controls the situation. The black box disappears on March 31, 1981 when Reagan is shot. The box disappears and doesn't come back, and then there's a fight over who's going to control it. You can read about it in the Washington Post. These are shifts of power. They are ascendancies of segments of the rich against other segments of the rich. They are sections of the people that control this country taking power. And what was ascending from the end of World War II on was a Southern Rim economy, a military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned about, and it took control that day. There's more evidence. I'm just giving you a piece, a slice, out of my own work and my own personal experience. The very first file that I went to see in the National Archives from the released records was from the National Security Agency box. It was about the only original file in the box, and it was called DEFCON status, November 22. DEFCON means defense condition, and they have an ascending number. They go from a flat to and all the way up to a 1, from a 5 to a 1. A 5 is a listen-up code, and then 4 is start to get ready, and 3 mobilize, and 2 is ready for war, and then 1, you actually go into war. And I looked at Continental United States that day in the file. I looked at USARUR, U.S. Army in Europe. I looked at ASEAN, which is the troops in Asia. I looked at SOUTHCOM. They had a sheet for each one. And on the day that Kennedy is assassinated, there is no change in status for the defense condition of the United States. No change. Even though they don't know who's killed the president, and even though the guy that's arrested later is a red, so they say, they have no change in status except in Vietnam. They go to a 5 listen-up code because things are about to change in Vietnam. So someone at the very top of that chain of command knew that there was no emergency that day, and they were in control. And it's time that we, the American people, took back that control and made a democracy out of the mockery that they've made of this country from that day forward. Throw the people who come forward now and say that I shot Kennedy is first that they are canaries singing from songbooks we wrote, because they have enough details from our research that's out to make a case that has verisimilitude. My second position on all of them is that there's no statute of limitations on the crime, that if someone says they shot Kennedy, take them to jail and let's see what they say then. Don't give them a book, don't make them famous, don't give them a video, just take them to jail. They say they killed Kennedy, because there are people making a buck off of saying they killed him now. Who knows? You know, I mean, I've always felt that identifying the gunman wouldn't get you very far anyway.
That's not where we're going.
Because the gunman would have been cutouts. If they'd been caught, they would have been cutouts. That wouldn't lead you back to who did it. I think it's Joint Chiefs. I mean, I think they had the green light from the rich and, you know, those that counted, but I think it was... Well, Lansdale on a mechanical level, but it's Curtis LeMay and Lyman Lemnitzer and Harley Burke and Maxwell Taylor.
Johnson knew
it was coming, I believe.
Any of those people still
alive? Johnson made a big argument about whether Connolly would sit with him or sit up in front. And then when Connolly's hit, Connolly said, "My God, they're going to kill us all." They were all expecting. Why did they kill Kennedy?
Yeah.
Because he was pulling out of Vietnam. He was ending the Cold War. He was normalizing relations with Cuba. He said he'd scatter the CIA to the four winds. He was pushing racial integration too fast for the Southern Rim.
What about
he was going after the mafia. I think it was a minimal amount. I mean, the right wing likes to talk about the Federal Reserve because that's the only thing they can understand, the centralization of banking. But there was a hell of a lot more that Kennedy did. And pissing off the Federal Reserve was not enough to get him killed.
Dave was flooded in Vatican II. He backed out of Vietnam. It
was a Catholic lobby to escalate the war. It was Alan Dulles and Cardinal Spellman who brought him Zim from the Catholic seminaries to go in as a leader. But he got the message, and especially got it when they killed Zim. You know, that they didn't care.
Was in Chicago earlier the year.
Yes, I think they did try to kill him in Chicago and Thomas Arthur Valley and that operation who was using the name Oswald. And
anyone working on that angle?
Sherman Skolnick did quite a bit on it, but there's some people, and there was an attempt in Florida too.
Right.
But he canceled it in Chicago. He didn't come to the game.
Right. Skolnick's
still alive?
Mm-hmm.
Not from the Chicago, right? I've been there a couple of times. He's still alive.
I don't know what Hunt did. I think it was like a schoolyard bully. And you go around, when you're a schoolyard bully, you go around and you get everybody you can get against the guy, and then you stand back while they beat him up. All right? And I think that was the game. I think they went to the anarchist or Cubans and said, "He's normalizing relations with Cuba." I think they went to the mob and said, "You don't like this SOB, do you?" I think they went to the Dallas Oilmen and said, "He's going to cut the oil tax depletion allowance. So don't you put some money up?" Because at the time, then, when they knocked him off, all of those could take credit. And later they could all take blame. But they're the fingers. They're not the palm. And there's no way that any of those groups individually could have decided with immunity to kill Kennedy. The mob couldn't have decided to knock him off and walk away.
Yeah, they had to have their backing with the gun.
Yeah, they do. So they didn't, you know, and they weren't doing it. And that whole thing that the mob was setting up to kill Castro, I don't believe that either. I think they were setting up domestic assassination capability, and if anybody ever noticed them, they say, "Oh, we're doing this to kill Castro." But Marcello said when he testified to the House Select Committee, he said, "You know, they asked me, were we trying to kill Castro?" He said, "No, we never tried to kill Castro. Why would we do that?" They were training
Johnson,
him to kill here
Johnson,
in the United States.
Johnson had to be
on. Well, Johnson had to know it was coming. He wasn't going to get his chance in 64. They were going to kick him off the ticket.
And Hoover, did he know it was coming?
Well, if he didn't know it was coming, he certainly helped cover it up.
What about the meeting that supposedly occurred with Carnegie?
Yes, there were some meetings here in town right before.
Johnson was there, right? Supposedly.
Yes.
Who was there?
Nixon.
Yeah.
Hoover was there.
Yeah. Ben Jones did work on this. Yeah.
Ben Jones.
Yeah, it's in his book. Forgive My Grief.
Oh yeah.
Forgive My Grief.
Yeah. Yeah. Stuff about that meeting, and one of Ruby's strippers was sent up to the meeting too.
Hey, did Ruby give the girls a the
Well, you can see that there's some frame splicing in the Zapruder film, and, you know, at certain points, splicing's fairly obvious. I don't know that many frames, but, I mean, you know, there were a few that were missing. The commission never saw it as a film. They only saw a sequence of frames that were printed in sequence, but Schoenfeld, who did the work, Lyndon Schoenfeld, in a memo, Hoover admitted that Schoenfeld made a technical error, is what he called it, and he reversed the key frames of the head frame so that it looked in the sequence they printed as if the head went the other direction. So, but they never saw it as a moving film. When they asked for a copy, they were sent a memo that said it was over at the CIA for training purposes. So they never saw it as a film. Yeah, well, that's how to do an assassination, I guess.
The Catholics all life, right? Is it?
In your opinion, in this country, is some type of congressional or grand jury investigation you think is ever going to happen?
I hope we'll have a grand jury investigation. That's what we need. A homicide investigation is what we need. Congress would just make a mess out of it like they did in the 70s. We need a forensic grand jury investigation. Dig up the body, do the ballistics. That's what we need. just treated as a homicide. That's what it was. And, you know, the rest is just a political game. But I think we know, and I think they wanted us to know. As much as they covered up, they also revealed. And while they never wanted the finger pointed exactly where it would go, the message to us, I think that as soon as anybody looks at this evidence, the conspiracy is transparent. So you still have 95-98% of the people, when they're polled, say they think the Warren Commission is wrong. Why? Because they are telling us, yeah, we shot the son of a bitch. What do you want to do about it? We can shoot the president. We sure as hell shoot you. Get out of the way. That's the message from Dallas. So they want us to know without officially knowing, and we do. But, you know, I mean, they can't shoot all of us, and we can die on our feet or die on our knees. I chose to stand up and yell at them. Ken Jones used to say, bite them at least on the way down. I mean, I may be a mosquito, but sometimes mosquitoes know where to bite. Because that segment of the group wanted Castro dead, the Joint Chiefs. But when they failed to kill him in the Texas theater, because I believe he stuck his hand down in the breech of the gun when they came to shoot him with it, then instead of a dead red, they had a talking head. And they had to get Ruby in there to shoot him 2 days later to shut him up, but it was too late. They couldn't afford to do the invasion then because he might have talked. And he was saying so much that they said, oh, we didn't take an oath, we didn't record anything. We didn't have to take a recorder back then. Yeah, right. Of course you didn't. You know, but here's the crime of the century, and you don't take it in a minute. And your question is, you know, the evidence is no good then. You can't use the thing he said in court. You don't have an oath.
Well, they knew it wouldn't go to court.
So. Yeah, that's right. They knew it wouldn't go to court, so why bother? But, you know, he was saying too much. And, you know, they had to shut him up, and they compromised him. But I don't think he owned that rifle. I don't think he owned the pistol. And I think the signature card was never retrieved on the box with his signature on it. A letter addressed to him at that box was in the dead letter. And I think they ordered the guns through that box in order to plant them on him. There were no fibers from the paper wrapping or from the blanket on the gun. There was no oil from the gun on either of the things it was supposedly wrapped in. That's right. Wasn't ordered under his name. Wasn't in his signature. Wasn't in his handwriting. He ordered a client's sporting goods. And, you know, I had these two old beefy Dallas cops come over to me at a table one time grinning. They said, like, we hear you don't think Oswald owned that rifle or pistol. And I said, I didn't say he didn't own any at all. I said, but I don't think he owned those ones they planted on him. And they said, what about that gun he brought into the theater with him? I said, I think you boys brought that gun in to kill him with. They looked at each other, they grinned, they said, well, maybe we did. I said, that'd be police procedure, wouldn't it?
It would be, I guess.
There's so much material when you start really studying the Kennedy administration and the assassination, what came after it. But the reasons that most likely he was killed, I think he touched upon, was definitely pulling out of Vietnam. And incredible that the policy changed on Monday following the Friday. He was shot on Friday at 12:30 Dallas time. The following Monday, Johnson just reversed the policy in Vietnam, and a 10-year war did proceed, costing the countries, just like the Iraq war, costing the countries hundreds of billions of dollars. And Kennedy talked about breaking up the mafia, working for a detente with the Soviets, and into the Cold War. I also think Kennedy might have signed on a joint U.S.-Soviet space program, which really ticked off the Pentagon. He was broaching normalization of relations with Cuba, and I think the CIA did get wind of that by tapping his phone and listening to what he said. I think in public, Kennedy did say anti-Cuba statements, but in public, I think he was reaching out to Cuba. He did, quote, threaten to scatter the CIA to the four winds in October and put Bobby, his brother, in charge of it. He was pushing racial integration, probably too slow for the civil rights community, but definitely too fast for the South, no question. Threatening the oil depletion allowance tax, which financed national elections. And this is so important because at the time he had threatened it, I think back in the 60s, was something like, I don't know, $20-30 billion, which was a lot of money then, especially now. And that's similar to your home to write off, is they can just write off all these wells and not pay their taxes. And that look who's been in charge now. I mean, the oil Bush, and it's incredible the consistency from JFK through Bush. Question? And he was bucking the Pentagon during the Bay of Pigs, and the again during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And most of us alive back then don't realize how close it really came to thermonuclear war. And the big chunk of the Pentagon, especially LeMay, who was satirized in the Kubrick movie Dr. Strangelove as Turgeson, right? Buck Turgeson. He was satirized in that movie about the missile gap. But back then, the United States knew they were way ahead of the Soviets, and they wanted to use the LeMay and the joints definitely wanted to use that excuse to go to thermonuclear war. It's all in the record. And they were going to take the losses. They had figured about 20 million Americans were acceptable losses to them. And that's back in the 60s when the country was about 150 million people. So sad, I know. And plus firing Alan Dulles and Richard Bissell from the CIA. Of course, Dulles, fired by Kennedy, ends up on the Warren Commission. Kind of scratch your head about that. And he was working to remove Hoover from the FBI had he been reelected in 64. And standing up to Wall Street and big business during the U.S. steel strike, he definitely, in my memory, was the last president to take labor position on anything. I mean, once Reagan got in, he became so rapidly anti-union, firing the Patco workers. But can you imagine a president standing up for labor? Wow, it's hard to believe, but it really happened. And ultimately, given people of the country its first sense of hope for an elected leader that might respond to the desire for peace, justice, and change. And I remember the day he was shot, and some of you do too, where I grew up in the Midwest. It was really a sad day. People were really just beside themselves watching the TV, and then later when Ruby, in the Dallas police station in the basement, they shot Oswald, people start scratching their heads and figure something wasn't right. I forgot what point I was going to make, but... It was a very sad day, and I talked to my mom about that. And I say, "What do you think would happen now if Bush got shot?" She said, "Boy, they'd be dancing in the streets." Now, I hope I don't offend any Republicans, but that's what she said. I'm just quoting my mom. Question?
John Judge kind of downplayed that idea about the connection with the Federal Reserve, the fact that Kennedy was starting to issue notes from the government rather than through the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just reading this book by Mullen about the Federal Reserve, and it seems to me that might have been a very important factor in Kennedy's assassination. What do you think? You probably read that.
Well, yeah, I mean, to a certain level, you almost can't separate the banks, joint chiefs, military, defense contractors. I mean, they all belong to the same country clubs. I mean, they know.
Yeah.
It's just part of the grease that keeps the wheels going. But there's a point to be made. I've studied the Fed like yourself and read a few books on it. It's tough to know how important that aspect of it was. I mean, I don't think it was a major reason why he was shot or he was eliminated. I mean, there were so many groups that were really mad at Kennedy, and as time went on, they just, like Prouty said at the beginning, they just couldn't work with this guy. He was just going his own way. Of course, he was going the way the public wanted him, wanted him to go. He was going with popular movements, the civil rights movements and disarmament movements and a few others. And the last, really the last president since to have gone with popular movements. But yeah, the Fed's a whole, I understand what you're saying. It's kind of tied up in the whole thing because the Feds are private banks anyway. Okay. And when we talk about the Kennedy administration, covers a lot of different issues, the Bay of Pigs, Cuban Missile Crisis, his Vietnam policy, the American University speech, which we have a new pamphlet for our group if anybody wants to sign and take it. And of course, there's the Jim Garrison investigation where he brought Clay Shaw to trial. And the, of course, the Bogus Warren Commission, similar to the 9/11 Commission, that, and you start studying about these commissions, they're mostly set up to control information, definitely not to get to the truth at all. And when you start looking at the members who make up these commissions, McCloy and the Warren Commission and Dulles and the 9/11 Cain Commission, and you see massive conflicts of interest where the public, the victims themselves, questions aren't even raised in these commissions, supposedly to follow the try to unearth the truth. But Operation Northwoods is a direct parallel between the JFK administration and 9/11, where Lyman Lemitzer of the Joint Chiefs of Staff came up with a plan to fly planes into buildings and blow them up and to plant phony evidence to blame it on Cuba. And they had wanted to invade Cuba for the longest time, and I think they still do. And they came awfully, country came awfully close in screwing that up and having those missiles fly. But the whole Cuban Missile Crisis history has been rewritten from the documents that have been released. And Cuba never, Castro never really had control over those nukes, thankfully. Soviets always had control. And questions? Yes?
You mentioned earlier, and a lot of the names that you were just talking about, some of the similarities between 9/11 and the JFK assassination, one of which was the media complicity with and assistance in the government line. And I was just a little boy when Kennedy was shot, but it still seems to me that the media, the corporate media complicity with 9/11 is much stronger and much more pronounced than with the Kennedy assassination. It seems to me that there was a lot of information out there challenging, and a lot of people weren't sure what they believed. But this 9/11 thing, it seems to me that they've got a lot more sophisticated in the way in which they try to support the government line and debunk anything that questions
it. Which, you know, it kind of works both ways, because when Kennedy was shot, they came up with a three bullet scenario, which they still stick to, and one of the magic bullet that goes in and out of people and this way and that way and hits a person. And as we'll see in 2 days, which is the anniversary of JFK, is they'll push the three bullet theory, and they'll push Oswald, and they'll push the Warren Commission. And it took a while, really, for some of the good research to come out, almost a 10-year lag time. Now, that didn't happen with 9/11, a lot of it due to the internet, and a lot of it due to researchers who've been following this stuff. So when 9/11 happened, and when building number 7 falls down without being hit, and you say, well, okay, and the explosions in the buildings, which came out the first day, and then all that covered up, it didn't take long for good material to come out on 9/11. We do have a pamphlet with about a good dozen books. So I think the lead time on 9/11 has been, on all these things, even the London bombing and Madrid, et cetera, as you start seeing, we start seeing the same pattern over and over again. Let's see, where's that going with that? But I think officially it's never going to be in their interest to come. And I think what he says before, I mean, they're going to, people who want to believe the lie, but it doesn't take too much figure, you know, looking at the situation, figure out, okay, well, they're obviously lying about World Trade, the whole 9/11. I mean, buildings just don't fall in controlled demolition. And the hijackers that they didn't know anything about it, and the same day they released, what was it, 19 hijackers, and seven of them are still alive, and they still haven't changed who, Chad?
I just have another question.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
What amazes me is the media. If you were to think about it, all the books that have come out about the 9/11, and excellent books, it's okay. You would think we were planning some explosions in this whole media, and we set them off and it's still standing, and we set off some more and it's still standing. So how come all the
Because our history is, has become a commodity of the national security state. There was some called Operation, Mockingbird, which was the infiltration of the media at all levels. I mean, when ABC began, ABC came right out of the CIA back, I think it was the late 50s, early 60s when ABC came. But when you start looking at, I mean, interesting, Dan Rather was a Cub reporter in Dallas the day of the assassination. And that's how he kind of became famous. He pushed the lie of how Kennedy, the way his head was shot, which way it snapped. So you have interests, big financial interests of who controls the media and why and what's released. And most people don't, you know, think about it. They don't read, they don't challenge. And truthfully, I think most Americans want to be lied to, honestly. They know that when you start looking at these assassinations, you start looking at what we do in Vietnam, Cambodia, Iraq, Guatemala, Argentina. I mean, there's just a whole litany of countries. It's not a pretty picture, but it's done in our name. So I think to some extent, most Americans would rather not know.
And, well, is it having to go outside this country to bring about any change?
Well, we will discuss that at the next meeting. Bruce.
Could you talk a little bit about Governor Connally? Was his shooting an accident or intention? And
I think it was, just briefly, I think it was an accident. I don't think he was meant to be shot.
With all that was going on around him in Texas, was he aware
He did. I'm pretty sure he knew. I think Connally knew. And he's, if not, he figured it out pretty quickly if you look at some of the statements he made right after that.
Why would he take such a chance of sitting there then? If he knew it.
Well, I know.
Why would he take such a chance with the fusillade he knew would be imminent?
That's a good question. Yeah. The Connally thing is pretty interesting, almost a sideshow, but Connally did run in the primaries for president back in the 68 and 72, I believe, if I remember correctly. Okay, well, let's move on with, yes, Cherry?
Just a quick comment. I've heard for years that the American public wants to be lied to. I don't think it's that so much as if they start suspecting the government that they believe in is involved, I think there's that terrible feeling that what we we don't know what to do with it. It's a terrible burden. So I think that's where it is more than anything else. I think that's why it's such a question.
Good. I agree to some extent.
Isn't there something, there's kind of a madness thing, too. There's one teacher that says, you know, when you're looking at all of these sources of information, and they all agree, well, then you have to be sort of mad. Would you go against all of that? You know what I mean? And then it strikes you that, and if you were to go down that road for madness, you'd be saying that, oh my God, my own government's a murderer, so where does that lead
you?
Yeah.
It's like, if you like a Chomsky, no Chomsky, the reporter still believes in the magic bullet.
Okay.
And you know, the man is Chomsky. Yeah, well, he did a few years ago. I suspect he still does.
Chomsky.
It's too brilliant to believe that. So I suspect that it's more that the man wants to
honest, you never liked Kennedy.
I think a lot of people on the left, they, you know, Chomsky pushes this sort of institutional analysis. And it's like, you know, all the wrongs of the world are the result of the institutions of capitalism. And you sort of, it's not, you know, there's this kind of phony belief that, well, you know, if you think that there are conspirators who do evil things, all you have to do is get rid of those bad people and everything will be all right. Well, that is not what we're saying. What we're saying is that all that power corrupts people so absolutely. You know, I mean, Cheney was not born evil, but he's become a very evil man. He's been totally corrupted by power. And this is going to happen. Institutions do that to people. But if you're going to believe the institutional theory, they can say there's no such thing as a war criminal. You know, can't blame Hitler and Hitler go on and on. No, I mean, they were just mere mortal companies. The institutions that did it, you know, I mean, it's a crazy belief. There are a lot of, you know, so-called socialists who go along with that. Because it fits in, you know, they can sit around and have nice little polite discussions about capitalism and inevitability of socialism sometimes in the future. Yeah, you know, it's very complicated, and they only have to do a whole lot. They go out and march, and out and push, and stuff like that. So, you just kind of, you know, just never block.
For those who don't know, that was Herr Hagelin from KBOO, a senior wise man in the music of the Illinois.